Better yet, I'll give you a nickel. Just stop asking me to find the one that's missing. In August 1965, the war in Southeast Asia was rolling. I had signed up for ROTC in 1961 when I was a freshman and Vietnam was just starting. I figured that if it grew, I'd rather go as an officer than as a grunt. I had tried grunt and didn't like it. Officer was better. Officer was like a member of the country club. Grunt was the guy who carried the bag. I knew I'd rather be the one telling the guy where to put the mortar than the guy carrying the mortar, so I signed up for Air Force ROTC. Then a friend told me that I could always go to Officer's Candidate School, OCS, once I had my college degree. Why should I do 4 years of this Mickey Mouse ROTC stuff when I could do 6 months of OCS later, and only if I had to? So I quit ROTC. That was a mistake. Big mistake. True, OCS was only 6 months, but there were 4 more months of intensive training before you got in. And those 10 months made ROTC look like a picnic. After graduation, I went on a couple of interviews, but couldn't get a job offer. I was so 1A, nobody would hire me. 1A was the draft board's term for being prime draft material. It was obvious the only job offer I was going to get was to serve my country. There was nothing wrong with me. I wasn't flat-footed, I had 20/20 vision, and I wasn't married. The draft was in full force, and this was after the lottery, so they were taking everybody. If you were 1A, you were going, unless you came up with something really tricky. Since I couldn't get a real job, I had to move back in with my parents and try to get a part-time job while I dealt with getting into OCS. I went down to the White Horse, a very nice dinner club where I had worked when I was in high school. I introduced myself to the owner, which was kind of audacious for a former busboy. But once again, I didn't know any better. I said to the owner, "Okay, here's my problem. I'm going to go into the military sooner or later, but in the meantime, I'd like a job. I don't want to be a busboy. I'm 22 years old and a college graduate, so I don't want to be a busboy. I really don't want to be a waiter either. I think I'd like to be a bartender." To my surprise, he said, "Okay." I promise you, there is another society out there in America that is asleep right now. This society is made up of the night people. It's people who work as waiters, waitresses, and all the other people that serve the entertainment and restaurant industry. They don't live in the daytime. They live at night. Within the night people's society, a bartender is very high on the totem pole. It's the same as being a doctor or a lawyer with day people. With night people, the head bartender at the right restaurant is right up there near the top. Within the night people's society, the head bartender at the Waldorf Astoria in New York is a dude. All the waitresses, waiters, and busboys think he's neat. The only guy cooler than the head bartender is the maitre d'. So if you're the number two bartender, you're not far off the top. This was like being a Charlie Robke among the night people. All of a sudden, I found myself at the ripe old age of 22, very high up in the night people's society. I had 30-year-old waitresses who thought I was cute, and when they found out that I was going away to war, oh. You're in the army now. Meanwhile, I was having a problem getting into OCS, and the draft board was closing in. Why the problem? Well, because I had 2 misdemeanors on my record, both of which were related to spring breaks in Florida. 1 misdemeanor was for using a hotel's wooden deck chairs as firewood for a bonfire on the beach in Daytona. It seemed like a good idea at the time. The other was for breaking into an outdoor display case in Fort Lauderdale and trying to steal a mounted sailfish to take back to the frat house. I can't even recall if that seemed like a good idea at the time. So when I tried to get into OCS and a question on the application form asked, "Have you ever been arrested?" I had to put yes. To get into OCS, I had to go to Washington. My father knew a federal judge, and Pat's father was best friends with a congressman from Tennessee. So I went to Washington and met with the judge and the congressman. The federal judge was nice to put on the application, but it was the congressman who got the job done. This is when I learned that having hooks works. Knowing the right person to get something done will get it done. He said to me, "You sure you don't want to be in the Navy? The Navy owes me big. I could do the Navy real easy." The deal was, in the Army's College Option OCS, when you graduated and got commissioned, you only had to serve 2 years. The Navy was 3. The Air Force was 4. I was very interested in doing this in as short a time as possible. I said, "No, sir, I really want to be in the Army." The congressman just picked up the phone, called the Army, and bingo, I got in the Army OCS. Now that's what I call having hooks. Basic training and OCS are a lot like the pledge games in the fraternity. They test you by giving you things to do in impossibly short time frames. They do it to see what happens to you when you get stressed out. That's the game. Let's give this guy an impossible situation and see what happens. It's like weeding out students with freshman English. If you don't know it's a game and how to play it, you will stress out. Their game plan is to get as many people as possible to quit in as short a time as possible. If you're focusing on this thing like it's really serious, then the training is very stressful. If you're focusing on it like, "This is a game and all these clowns are doing is trying to drive me crazy," it isn't hard. I had no problem with it. It was difficult in the sense that it was physically demanding, but it wasn't hard psychologically. I knew it was a game, and I understood their rules and their motivation. The top 20% in the class were invited to stay at Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland, to be instructors for the new Ordnance OCS program. Being an instructor is a great way to learn public speaking because you're in front of a bunch of officer candidates who have to be there and you outrank them. You don't have to be worried that they're going to be unhappy with the job you're doing. You're the lieutenant and they're the candidates. You're in total control. So if they make one wrong move, you shoot them. Since then, I've spoken to audiences of 50 or more people more than 100 times, and I love it. After I graduated from OCS and became an OCS instructor, I had to go through Military Occupational Specialty, MOS, school. The first day of MOS school, a general came in and talked about the course. Then he said that at the end of the course, they would recognize an honor graduate based on the highest academic standing and the highest this and the highest that. I went home that night and said to Pat, we were married by then, "This is it. Everybody has been giving me this BS all my life that I don't do what I ought to do and I don't work to potential. All right, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to be the damn honor graduate. I'm going to be that man. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do whatever it takes to be that guy." At the end of the course, I was the honor graduate. I couldn't believe it. I had done it, and it wasn't even that hard. All I did was figure out what the rules of the game were and then followed them. Naturally, I had accepted the Army's offer to be an instructor at Aberdeen. It was great. I became well known within the ranks as being a very good instructor. I was good at it. It's very easy to be an instructor when you say the same thing every week and they change the people you're saying it to. There's a lot of stuff I can't do, like math and statistics, but when he was passing out talents, he said, "And this one gets the gift of gab." I was the first lieutenant at Aberdeen to become a master instructor. It was just another game to me. You had to do a bunch of BS, and I did it. It wasn't hard. Every other master instructor had been at least a captain, and most were majors or lieutenant colonels. I was only a second lieutenant, the lowest ranking officer there is. The master instructor title, OCS training, and the MOS honor graduate were the same deal. It's a game. They wrote these rules. I understand these rules. I can follow these rules and win the game. It's no big deal. It isn't hard. Some of it was aggravating, but I didn't take it personally. There was nothing personal about it. They didn't know I existed when they wrote the rules, so it was totally impersonal. You can either play the system or you can let the system play you. Pick one. I like playing the system because it's more fun and you win more. If you let the system play you, you can get very frustrated and very beat up. After 13 months at Aberdeen, I received orders sending me to South Korea. My record was starting to build. I'd just gotten the medal for the job I did as an instructor and the Master Instructor Honor. The Army is very big on that stuff, so I got promoted to First Lieutenant. They made me the adjutant, the guy in charge of personnel, for a battalion. I was the S1 of the battalion at Camp Humphreys, Korea. It was all paperwork. I had to sign everything. I hated paperwork, but I did it. I also did the rest of my job with a little more flair than my predecessors. I came up with ideas and new ways of doing things. I became noticed. I was not very good at being invisible. One day I got a call from the XO, the number 2 man of the brigade, the unit above the battalion. He wanted to meet me for lunch. I cleared it with my boss. The military is very big on chain of command stuff, and met him for lunch. He offered me the job of S3, which was the operations officer of the brigade. Now, understand that this was the equivalent of number 3 man in the brigade. The organizational chart is the brigade commander, then the brigade XO, then the S3. I was about 5 steps away from that S3 position as the adjutant of the battalion, so this guy wanted to multi-promote me 5 steps. The S3 was usually a lieutenant colonel, and I was only a first lieutenant. Realistically, I should have to go through captain, then major, then lieutenant colonel before I'd even be considered for this job. I became S3 of the brigade at the ripe old age of 23. I had about as much business being an S3 as I did being a goalie on the Hartford Whalers. I didn't have any idea what I was doing. I was in way over my head, 6'3" in 10 feet of water. One of the missions of this brigade was 8th Army nuclear weapons storage. I had a sidearm. Top secret this, top secret that. Aye, 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 I'm 23 years old. What am I doing? Are these people nuts? I don't need this responsibility. Jesus Christ, this is scary. My only claim to fame is that I was a master instructor back in Aberdeen, and that was easy. 2 years ago, I was burning hotel deck chairs for a bonfire on a beach in Daytona, Florida, and now I'm sitting on World War III. I'm nervous about this. Someone else should have been doing this nuclear weapons thing. Since Vietnam was heating up so much during the 1960s, Korea was kind of in the background. Until the Pueblo incident. In 1968, the North Koreans captured the intelligence ship USS Pueblo in international waters. The world would have been real scared if it had known that I had the position I had during the Pueblo affair. My experience in the military reinforced my view that it really was money that was important in life, not what you did to make it. In the military, it's the other way around. Your job is more important than money. Sure, I was S3 as a first lieutenant instead of a lieutenant colonel, but I wasn't getting a lieutenant colonel's pay. I was only too happy to return to the real world again, where money was what counted. My mother had gotten me into Xavier University in Cincinnati on probation as a student in their MBA program. I was on probation because I only had a 2.2 grade point average coming out of undergraduate school. Pat and I moved to Cincinnati and got an apartment. She started teaching, and I started school. Because of my experiences in the Army, and especially because of what I had proved to myself by being the honor graduate, I wanted to do well in school this time around. I decided A's were better than C's. Fortunately, most of the classes I was taking were easy for me, marketing and economics, and no statistics or math. I don't like math. I can do arithmetic as well as anybody, but arithmetic and math aren't the same thing. I don't like formulas. If you put an X and a Y on a page, I go, I don't care. Hire somebody to do that. I cruised through the first semester classes. Most of the other people in the program were General Electric engineers coming back to school to get their MBAs. There was a big GE plant outside Cincinnati in Evandale, and these guys were all either chemical or electrical engineers. They all carried slide rules on their belts. This was during the dark ages before handheld calculators, but most couldn't spell marketing or economics. Then we had to take a course called Quantitative Business Methods. It was a math course. The first day of class, this geek math teacher, who was a total math teacher, dull, dry, and two slide rules on his belt, started out by saying, "To pass this class, you will need a working knowledge of calculus." Oops, I hadn't taken calculus. I wasn't going to take calculus. I couldn't spell calculus. But I had to have this course to graduate. I sat through the first few classes, but I didn't understand any of it. All these geeks I'd been laughing at in all these other courses were doing fine. They understood everything he was talking about. They had their little slide rules out, arguing over the third place decimal to the answer, and I couldn't even get the right handle. I studied for 2 days for the first test, and still only made a 38, the lowest grade in the class. By a lot. So I called a buddy of mine I had gone to high school with who majored in math at Notre Dame. "Ralph, I need a tutor. I mean, I'm in deep, deep shit here. I'll pay you. I've got to pass this course. I don't know what I'm doing. I need somebody who can talk to me and make sense out of this stuff." He agreed to help me. The game was, I didn't care if I knew any of it. He just had to get me to where I could pass this course. I studied my tail off. I still didn't know any of it, but I did pull a C in the course. The point was, I was laughing at all those guys in all the other classes because they couldn't carry my jockstrap in economics and marketing, and all of a sudden I couldn't carry their jockstraps in math. That taught me that there are people for places, places for people. You can do some things, and you can't do other things. Don't get all upset about the things you can't do. If you can't do something, pay someone else who can and don't worry about it. The Brain Watchers and the Butterfly. Since my grand plan was to go into business and make a lot of money, becoming a stockbroker seemed like the perfect job. It's really just a well-respected sales job, but if you're good at it, the pay is super. I decided to get acquainted with some prospective employers for when I finished the MBA. I went down to the street in Cincinnati, and I started going to all the brokerage offices. Bosch, DuPont, Hornblower, some of the names don't even exist anymore. I was looking for a part-time job that would accommodate my school schedule. The deal I wanted was this. I can work part-time 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. I don't care what I do. I don't care what I get paid, if I get paid. But when I finish graduate school, I want to go into your training program and become a registered broker. At most of the big firms, I was a round peg in their square hole. They wanted full-time or nothing. One major wirehouse was the exception. I walked into this office on just the right day in 1968. One of the biggest brokers in the office was primarily a commodities broker, and I happened to walk in the day after his assistant had quit. This broker was producing $300,000 to $500,000 a year in gross commissions in commodities in 1968. He was a big hitter. The office manager's secretary said, "You'll have to talk to the office manager, Mr. Fitzgerald." I went in to talk to Larry Fitzgerald, and he said, "What do you know about commodities?" I didn't know anything, but I remembered a few of the buzzwords from the meeting I had with Jack Salmon and Dr. Christian in college. I said, "I've always been interested in futures. I'm particularly interested in the soybeans and meal and oil, trying to figure out how the weather is going to affect the crop." I used the buzzwords I had heard Salmon use. Fitzgerald said, "Okay, you're hired, if Cohen wants you. Go out and meet Ed Cohen." Cohen was the big commodities broker. Fitzgerald introduced me to him, and after a very short interview, Cohen said, "Okay, you're hired." On my way out of the office, Fitzgerald's secretary told me to come back the next day to fill out an application and take a test. "Test? What kind of test?" I asked. She said it was called the Minnesota Study of Values test. Without knowing it, she had just let me know that there was a game to be played. This time the game was a test. I didn't know anything about this test, but I planned to find out about it. I went straight to a bookstore and found a book titled The Brain Watchers that had three chapters on the Minnesota Study of Values test. I bought the book and read it that night so I'd be ready for the test the next day. The questions on the MSV test have five multiple-choice answers that you rank in their order of importance to you. The five categories of answers are money, politics, aesthetics, religion, and social significance. For example, one question I remember was, "When you look at Leonardo da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper, what do you feel? Rank the following in their order of importance, one being the most important and five being the least important. The social implications of the event, the beauty of the painting, the value of the painting, the political impact of the painting, the religious ramifications of the painting." Depending on what kind of job you are applying for, there is a right way and a wrong way to rank the answers. If you want to be a broker, the ranking for the question above is as follows. The highest ranking is the money answer, followed by the politics answer, social significance, aesthetics, and finally, the religion answer. If you want to go to work as a parish priest, every right first answer is the religion answer, then social, and so on, and the money answer is always last. Once you know that's how their game is played, the test isn't hard. It's very simple. You can see very quickly which one of the five choices represents each of the categories, then you just rank them the way you believe the employer wants them ranked. So the next day I took the test and gave them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, money, politics, social significance, aesthetics, religion, on every question. I didn't even miss one on purpose to make it look good. That was a small mistake. I should have reversed 1 and 2 a couple of times, but I didn't. My test was perfect. Absolutely no wrong answers. Now, when they grade this test, it comes out on a scattergram chart. If you're meant to be a broker, your scattergram looks something like a butterfly. Well, mine came out a perfect butterfly. Fitzgerald didn't care. He was going to hire me unless I really blew the test. But he did say, "You really did well on that test. I haven't seen anybody do that well before." I told him I had studied a little bit before I took the test. "You're not really able to study for that test." "Well, you are and you aren't," I said. The next day, I started working as Cohen's assistant. It was 1968 and the stock market was booming. It was going straight up and everything was wonderful. Everyone in the office was making money. Then suddenly it stopped going up and it started going down. When that happened, the only guy in the office making money was Ed Cohen. He was still doing business, and everyone else was looking at their phones. I said to myself, "Self, I think I'm going into futures. I like the idea that I'm not at the mercy of the market only going up. I like the idea of being able to make money when the market goes down, too." I don't care how good a stockbroker you are. If the market is going down, you're in trouble. You've got to take a defensive posture and you're not going to do as much business. I finished the MBA program in September 1969, and as part of the deal I made with the brokerage firm, I was off to the 3-month broker training program in New York. I went to the Big Apple a month before the program started and spent that time in the futures division rubbing elbows with all the biggies. I wanted to know how they did what they did and why, what worked and what didn't work. I was on a fast track because I'd been working for Ed Cohen for a year, so everyone in the Futures division in New York knew who I was. I was the one with the perfect butterfly chart. Once again, I got the impression I was better than the others. I was more equal than the other trainees because I knew most of the people in the Futures division and I worked for Cohen. Once we got into the actual training program, I ended up teaching part of the commodity portion of the program. The regular instructors were from New York, and they sort of knew what to say as far as the tests were concerned. But they didn't really know futures because the big futures exchanges were in Chicago. They quickly figured out that I did know what was going on, and they made me an assistant instructor. When they had questions on commodities, they would come to me. If I didn't know the answer, I knew I could get the answer from Cohen. Once again, I had the Midas touch and a hook. Someone on the staff told somebody back in the Futures division that I'd been a very big help teaching the class, and I got a call from Tom O'Hare, the firm's tax straddle expert. He did huge production, $2 million or $3 million a year, all on referrals from stockbrokers. A broker would call and say, "I've got a client who's made $2.5 million this year. Can you do a tax trick?" Tom would say, "Yeah. How big a trick do you want? How much of that is he willing to risk to try to do it?" Tom O'Hare was a master at it. Well, Tom called me and wanted to see me in his office. When I got there, we exchanged pleasantries, and then he pulled out my file. He said, "I really wanted to meet the prima donna who actually had the gall to paint a perfect butterfly." "I'm sorry, sir. I don't know what you're talking about." "Yes, you do. Nobody could do a perfect butterfly unless he knew exactly what I'm talking about." "Well, I read a book. That book wouldn't be The Brain Watchers, would it?" "Well, let me see. As I recall, yes, I think that was the name of the book, and it helped me a lot on the test." He said, "Okay, how close do you think you would really have come to the butterfly if you hadn't read the book?" "To be honest, pretty close. If I hadn't known the game, I still wouldn't have been far off." "I wanted to be part of the country club set, remember? I already believed money was important." "Okay, this is what I do." Then O'Hare proceeded to tell me about tax straddles. The entire firm sent him referrals who were willing to risk some capital to reduce their tax liability legally. O'Hare needed an assistant. "I'm authorized to hire an assistant. I want someone who can learn what I do, understand what I do, and help me do what I do. That way we can do a lot more business. I've looked at your test. We both know that's BS, but I give you credit for having done it. I've talked to your boss, Ed Cohen. He thinks you're a bright young man. I want you to come to work for me. I'll pay you $23,000 a year." My alternative was to go back to Cincinnati as a broker under Cohen, basically as his assistant. But that wouldn't be bad. He was 52 years old, and he had a client book that was massive. He wasn't going to be there forever, so whoever went to work for him was going to inherit the book and make a lot of money. Back in Cincinnati, I was probably going to make $15,000 to $18,000, plus whatever I could produce by getting my own customers. At that time, a $100,000 producer would have netted about $25,000, big money in 1968. And this guy was offering me $23,000. I said, "Mr. O'Hare, I'm extremely flattered that you called me in to see you. I think working with you would be absolutely super. But as flattered as I am, I don't think I can take the job." Well, immediately it became obvious that this was not the kind of guy who was told no very often, particularly by some 24-year-old who didn't know where the washroom was. "What do you mean you can't take the job?" "Well, it's that number. I really don't want to live in New York, and neither does my wife. I could do it. I could open a travel agency in Kabul, Afghanistan, if the numbers were right. I have a new bride who's pregnant with our first child, and she doesn't want to move to New York. We could deal with it. but there would have to be some compensation for dealing with it, and quite frankly, $23,000 doesn't do it. What do you mean? What are you going to make in your first year in Cincinnati? Well, all I have to do is $100,000 in gross production, and I'll make at least $25,000. Plus, you know Larry Fitzgerald is going to give me a bonus if I do $100,000 my first year. I'll probably make 26 or 27 grand. So why would I want to come to New York for 23 grand when I know the odds are... Wait a minute. You're going to do 100 grand your first year? Well, yeah, I think so. But aren't you going to be working for Cohen? Yes, sir. But he can't handle his book. His book is huge. I'll take what he can't get to. I think I can gross $150,000 out of his book in my spare time. Okay, I'll offer you $27,000. $30,000. Get out of my office. I went a little too far? Yep, you went a little too far. Get out of my office. Mr. O'Hare, it's been a pleasure. I hope you have considered it a pleasure. I'll talk to you in a year and we'll see who was right. I won't forget. Please, don't you forget, because, honest to God, I am flattered that you invited me in here and offered me the job. I did $162,000 my first year, one of the highest production figures a rookie at the firm ever did. I called O'Hare and said, I am LOS-2, length of service 2 years, as of today. Go over and check your little machine. You're going to find I did $162,000. I was right, and you knew I was right. Plus, Fitzgerald gave me a little kicker. I made 26.7% out of that $162,000. I made $43,000 in Cincinnati, which spends a lot better than $27,000 in New York. Would you like to reopen negotiations? I'm now a $50,000 offer. He laughed and said, No, I've gotten someone who may not have the chutzpah you do, but he'll do just fine for $28,000. Three. Would that I would trade. A year after I started working for Cohen, the firm decided to start something called Regional Trade Units. The home office told us that if we were going to be in this region and do futures business, we had to be in Cleveland. I believed them. That was a mistake. I should have stayed with Ed Cohen. Unfortunately, he didn't tell me that was possible until it was too late. Cohen was the proverbial 500-pound canary. He could do whatever he wanted. If he told the higher-ups that he wanted me to stay, I would have been able to stay. He was a great guy, but he wasn't aggressive. He didn't say, Hey, Jim, you don't have to do that. You can stay and work with me. So I figured I had to move to Cleveland. I was flattered to be invited to interview for a job in the regional trade unit, considering that I was a 24-year-old with only 1 year of experience. I was offered a position in Cleveland, and I took it. The deal was, all the stockbrokers in the region would refer their futures business to 2 other futures brokers and me, and take a split of the commissions. I moved to Cleveland in May 1970, and did a lot of business my first year, most of it in lumber. I developed a good client base and contacts in the lumber industry. One day, our little group, which had grown to 5 from 3, did more business in futures than all of the 112 stockbrokers in the office did in securities combined. Between knowing Cohen, teaching in New York, and producing some of the firm's best LOS one figures ever, I was pretty full of myself. I continued to believe that I was different and better than the run-of-the-mill broker. Believing I could bend or break the rules led me to do something really stupid. Not illegal, just a little ahead of its time, and more than just a little against firm policy. One of my customers had a trading system, and he wanted to manage some outside money. He proposed that I raise $30,000 and put it into an account. He would trade the account, take no fees, and split profits and losses 50-50 with the customers who had put up the money. This sort of arrangement is done all the time today, and usually under terms much less advantageous for the customer. Today, there are usually fees, and no money manager shares in the losses. So I raised the money and informed the customers exactly what we were doing, and they signed papers agreeing to the terms. I even documented the arrangement with the state securities authorities by registering the account as a limited partnership. But I opened the account as an individual account, which it really wasn't. Well, the guy made money for a while, but then he started losing money. After he lost $20,000 of the customer's money, I started getting antsy and said, "Okay, no big deal, but you need to put up your half of the losses, $10,000. He sent a check. The check bounced. Naturally, that caught the attention of the operations manager. The long and short of it is that the trader lost the original $30,000 and $20,000 more. He couldn't or wouldn't pay the $20,000 owed to the firm, and I got fired. I was terminated for cause, which is a big no-no as far as the New York Stock Exchange is concerned. I got blackballed. I couldn't get a job anywhere. Soon after that, the firm collected the money from the client, but a fat lot of good it did me by then. So I called my friend Jack Salmon, who by then was the president of the regional brokerage firm he was working for when I met him back in college. I hadn't had a job for 3 months, and I really didn't want to go to work for a regional firm, but you gotta do what you gotta do. I still had a client base that I thought I could move. "I'm sure I can move the lumber accounts. Do you know any firms where I could take my business?" I said. "Come work for us," he said. "My Cleveland office could really use your talents. I'll pay you 50% of gross. Plus, I'll pay you a 5% override on the whole office." My previous employer had only paid me 25% of gross, so this was a great deal if I could continue to do the business. Sometimes knowing the right people and being in the right place at the right time can make all the difference in the world. I went to work for Salmon in a tiny 4-man office in Cleveland. Most of my accounts transferred over, so business was back to normal fairly quickly. I made good money between January 1973 and July 1976. All the commodity markets got hot when Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971, and the grain markets went crazy in 1973 and 1974. My clients were making money, and I was making money. I bought a house and a sports car. I went to the managers' meetings, and I was honored as the leading manager based on production improvement. Once again, I encountered the Midas touch syndrome. Everything I touched turned to gold. I didn't think things could get any better than that, but they did. Chicago. The only commodity exchange membership I had ever wanted was one that would enable me to trade lumber without having to pay for the right to trade all the other commodities, which came with a full membership. In 1976, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange created exactly that kind of membership. Leo Melamed, chairman of the CME at the time, came up with a brilliant gimmick to pay for the new Merc building by selling equity in the exchange without diluting the full memberships. He created a non-livestock membership, NLM, that permitted you to trade lumber and eggs. The NLM seat cost $20,000, compared to the going rate of $125,000 to $150,000 for a full membership at the CME or the Chicago Board of Trade. I called Jack Salmon and said, "This is it. I want to move to Chicago. There's really no one in the office here in Cleveland other than me anyway, so let's bag this thing and I'll move to Chicago." I bought the seat and moved to Chicago in June 1976. I wanted to dress for success for my new job in Chicago. An old fraternity brother of mine, Jimmy Showalter, had a men's clothing store in Lexington, Kentucky. Jimmy's store had nice clothes, Hickey Freeman kind of stuff. Not Armani, but very nice. I called him and asked if I could come into his store on a Sunday when he was closed and deck myself out in a new wardrobe. "Well, what are we talking about here, Jim?" he asked me. I could tell he didn't want to come in on a Sunday just for me. I said, I'm talking about spending some serious money on new clothes, maybe $8,000 or $10,000 to have it done right. Suddenly, Sunday didn't sound too bad to Jimmy. So I flew to Lexington and got a new wardrobe. When you buy a seat on the exchange, you get to select the call letters that will be engraved on your ID badge that other traders use to identify you when they trade with you in the pit. You want to stand out in the crowd so traders will trade with you often. Some people use their initials, nickname, or some catchy combination of letters that makes them easy to remember. In my case, since I was always looking for whatever edge I could get, I picked the initials L-U-C-K. I'd rather be lucky than good anyway. I thought by calling myself lucky, maybe I'd be lucky. Plus, it was very easy to remember. Everybody knew who Luck was. It was a badge that people could instantly identify with and remember. Learning the trading floor. Very quickly it became obvious to me that the best trader in the lumber pit was a guy named Stu Gimble. He was head and shoulders above everybody. Just like at the country club when I wanted to ingratiate myself with the movers and shakers, I wanted to get to know Gimble. So, not knowing any better, just like when I got my pledge pin, I walked up to him one day and said, Stu, can I take you to lunch? I don't go to lunch. Can I take you to dinner? Can I take you for a drink? Look, you can call it anything you want. I just want to go out and talk with you. You're the best trader in the pit, so you're the man I gotta talk to. Okay, we'll go to lunch. Once again, I set myself apart from the rest of the crowd by getting to be friends with Stu Gimble and another phenomenal trader on the floor, Joe Siegel. Joe moved around mostly in the pork bellies and the lumber pits. I learned a lot from the two of them. I still think Gimble was the best mechanical trader ever on the floor. Life in the fast lane. As part of this new non-livestock membership, the Board of Governors of the CME decided to have two new governors from the NLM group on the board. There was a nominating committee to choose four people from the NLM group to run for those two spots, and I was approached and asked if I'd be interested in running for the board. I guess I looked gubernatorial wearing these fancy schmancy clothes to the floor. The dress code for the floor was a tie and your trading jacket. No jeans or tennis shoes. Everybody else was wearing khakis and corduroys, and I was walking around in $600 vested suits. I'd have my trading jacket on over a vest and a $50 tie. I was well-dressed for just about any business environment, but on the floor I was extremely well-dressed. Once again, I thought I was a little different from and a little better than other people. The idea of a contest for a Board of Governors seat was flashing game to me. It was like freshman English, mind games in the military, and the MSV test. I said, sure, I'd love to be a candidate. Now, what do you do when you're in high school and someone asks you to run for student council? You say, sure, but then you don't run, you anti-run. Everything is done to de-emphasize it because you don't want the embarrassment of trying and losing. So I said to myself, self, whether you lose because you didn't run for the Board of Governors or whether you lose because you ran hard, it's the same outcome. So let's really run hard. Let's get aggressive and try to get elected. And if you don't get elected, you don't get elected. Big deal. I did everything I could to get elected. I sent platform letters. I had Jack Salmon send letters. Then I sent handwritten letters asking for votes. Well, nobody else was really running. They were all doing the I don't want to run because I don't want to lose routine. If you run aggressively in that situation, you win by a landslide. I won 121 votes out of 150 votes. I was elected to the Board of Governors of the CME after only 6 months in Chicago. I was 33 years old, looked like I was 25, and acted like I was 22, but I was on the Board of Governors. After the election, Leo Melamed came up to me and said that I would also represent the NLM on the executive committee of the Board of Governors, since I had the most votes in the election. It turned out the executive committee was where everything really happened. Anytime you see a committee of more than 10, it isn't the real committee. There's a subcommittee somewhere making the decisions. So the board at that time was 18 members, and the executive committee was 6. I couldn't believe I had just been elected to the Board of Governors, and I didn't even know the executive committee existed. But suddenly, I was on it. I had only been in town 6 months, and I was elected because I had presence, wore a vest and $80 shoes, knew a lot about the markets, and knew a lot of people in the industry. Through a series of chance occurrences, I became a player in the cradle of the futures industry. All of a sudden, I was in the inner circle. Fortunately, once I got there, I wasn't bad at the game. I played by the rules and became very involved in the exchange and the industry. It was a very heady experience to be an exchange official after such a short time in Chicago, and to be friends with the two best traders on the floor after such a short time in the pit. I began to think of myself as one of the bigger players. I was going to the floor every day. And while most of my trading was still focused on customer business, I was starting to trade more for my own account. I was probably making $200,000 to $300,000 a year and spending a lot of it. I can't even remember half the stuff I bought. I also made investments that I can't even remember. My ego was getting fed from all quarters. I was a governor, a member of the executive committee, and friends with Gimbel and Siegel. I was a little different. I was a little better than the rest of the crowd, just like getting my pledge pin in college and the multi-promotion in the military. I remember one morning I was heading out the door on my way to work, and I stopped at the mirror in the hall tree to straighten my tie. I looked at myself, and I said, "God damn, life in the fast lane." Life was great, and I didn't think it could get any better. But it did. Zenith. There was another guy at my firm who was also involved in the lumber market. Larry Broderick had come from the cash lumber business and was working in our St. Louis office. Both of us were doing some business with Potlatch, a huge paper manufacturing and lumber firm in the Northwest. The Potlatch family had been cutting wood since Noah's flood, and the guy who ran their trading operation was a guy named Tom Jack. One day Tom Jack called me and said, "This is stupid. We've got you doing your thing in Chicago and Broderick doing his thing from St. Louis. You guys ought to be working together. Why don't we all get together, have lunch, and talk about it?" When we met him on the West Coast for lunch, he said, "Look, guys, together you two would make the best single broker in the business. Why don't you figure out a way to work together and stop being two independents?" So we did. We became partners, and very shortly we started doing a lot of business because the arrangement really worked. Larry had fantastic connections in the cash market, and I had great floor information and execution services. I was walking into the lumber pit every day with big orders. Buy 50 of this, sell 100 of that. When you start doing size like that in the pit, it can really go to your head. The other people in the pit don't know whether the orders are for your account or for a client's. It also makes it very easy to start trading that kind of size for your own account. I was the biggest broker in the pit in terms of doing size orders. Larry and I had a large percentage share of the market. Lumber volume was something like 3,000 or 4,000 contracts a day, and we were doing 600 or 800 contracts a day between client and personal trading. At 6'3" with a booming voice and 100 lot orders, I became a presence in the pit. So not only did I think I was neat, but a lot of other people did too. I thought I was different and somehow better than other people, like I had some sort of Midas touch. I might have thought it was true, but it wasn't. Little did I know that all the times I thought I was good, I had only been lucky. For example, when I was sent to Korea and became an S3 as a second lieutenant, was it because I was good or lucky? Lucky. Everyone else was sent to Vietnam, so there was a personnel shortage in Korea. When I happened into that brokerage the day after Cohen's assistant quit, was it because I was good or lucky? Lucky. When I became a board governor and executive committee member after only 6 months in Chicago, was it because I was good or lucky? Lucky. The successes in my life had given me a false sense of omniscience and infallibility. The vast majority of the successes in my life were because I got lucky, not because I was particularly smart or better or different. I didn't know it at this point in the story, but I sure as hell was about to find out. Four. Spectacular Speculator. Timber Tumbles. I will never forget the first day I made $5,000 trading. I felt exactly the same way I did the first day I made $5 caddying when I was 10 years old. To make the $5, I caddied all day long. I made $5 for 10 hours of carrying a golf bag. 50 cents an hour. It was the greatest feeling in the world. Then there was the first day I made $10,000. Same feeling. Then the first day I made $20,000, and so on. I remember one Thanksgiving I was at home in Kentucky with my folks and my brother. The Friday after Thanksgiving, my brother and I flew to Chicago so he could see what I did for a living. I was long the lumber market and losing about $40,000 or $50,000 on this position when we arrived in Chicago. We went into the lumber pit and I explained how everything worked. Then, to demonstrate how things worked, I bought 10 contracts. The market went down and I bought some more. After a little while, the market turned and roared to the upside, and I bought it all the way up. We walked out of the pit with $37,000 in an hour of trading. It was just one of those days when the market was going to go up because I was buying it. Some days you just can't do anything wrong. Including all the money my customers made that day, plus all the commissions I generated, we made about $100,000. And it felt just the same as that first day I made $5 caddying. In December 1980, Broderick and I were at the height of our business. We had accounts with everybody who was anybody in the lumber business, so we had a very impressive customer list and an equity run with over $3.5 million on it. We were approached by the new president of another regional firm. He was trying to turn it around and wanted us not only for our customer business, but also for my stature in the industry. If I went with his firm, he would gain some immediate credibility that he was turning this little firm around. So he made us a deal that was just crazy. 50% payout, expense accounts, super neat office, fancy furniture, built-in bar. I literally told him at the time that there was no way he was going to make any money on the deal, but he did it anyway. This was probably the zenith of my career. I was making plenty of money, I had good accounts, I was on the executive committee and board of governors. Life was great. With interest rates skyrocketing in 1979 and 1980, the housing market and consequently the lumber market felt the pinch. The high interest rates depressed new home sales, the main market for lumber. Lumber prices plunged, and volume in the lumber pit dried up. It went from about 6,000 contracts a day down to 1,000. I don't care what your market share is, when the market shrinks by that amount, you've got problems. There was no longer enough business in lumber futures for me to maintain my lifestyle. The Arabian Horse Fiasco. I figured I could apply my money-making talents to other business ventures and maintain my lifestyle. I know what I'm doing, I'm smart, and I have the net worth to prove it. One of the smartest guys I ever met was Jim Gleesman. He was also one of the craziest people I ever met. He had this knack of being the big picture guy. He was always coming up with grand schemes to make money. In one of his schemes, we were going to buy an island off the coast of South America. It cost something like $2 million, but we were going to leverage the purchase by putting down only $100,000 and borrowing the rest using the teak wood grown on the island as collateral. We were going to harvest the teak wood, sell it, make a fortune, and then own the island for nothing. Gleesman was nuts. He was constantly coming up with these ideas. Every week he'd have a new way to make $1 million. One day he started talking about Arabian horses. You buy these beautiful horses and you breed them and you show them in horse shows and you make a lot of money. Are you sure that's right? Yeah. I never could get a handle on why or how you made a lot of money with these horses. These things don't do anything. They don't race or run the steeplechase. Nothing. They're show horses. You walk them around and somebody pays $2 million for this thing that walks around looking pretty. Sounded crazy to me, but Gleesman and I started looking at Arabian horses. He came up to me one day and said, I've got it. I found a couple who are getting divorced and they're selling everything they own in common to settle their divorce decree. They have an Arabian horse we can buy for $22,000. This was the first number he'd mentioned that I could even think about paying for a horse that didn't do anything. So we went and saw this horse. His name was Onyx. Onyx was beautiful, gorgeous, a dark gray Arabian. He had this pedigree and that pedigree and so on. Okay, let's do it. Buy the horse. What's it gonna cost? The minute you buy one of these things, the cash register just starts running. We had to transport it over to the stables, pay for room and board, pay the vet, and pay for training. After a few months, it was getting to be kind of expensive. We had something like $20,000 each in Onyx. Then, one day, I got a call from Gleesman. It's Onyx, he said. What do you mean, it's Onyx? They just checked Onyx into the emergency room of the Ohio State Equine Hospital. Ah, God, now what? He's got a rare blood disease. Naturally, we hadn't insured Onyx yet. We figured that after training him and documenting his pedigree, he was going to be worth more and we'd be able to insure him for a lot more. The SOB ran through another $30,000 before he died. The Arabian horse fiasco cost me about $50,000 before it was over. Here I was thinking I could make money in Arabian horses, and I couldn't even ride one. Soybean oil spreads. I decided to stay away from horses and stick with the markets, where at least I thought I understood what was going on. So as the lumber market dried up, my business changed. I gradually moved my business away from the floor and started handling more speculative customer business from upstairs, trading from a quote machine and doing more general futures business instead of just lumber. I started opening some speculative accounts and getting my lumber accounts interested in trading other markets too. With this change in my business, I needed some help. I knew a lot about the lumber market, but not too much about other markets. An old friend of mine, Kirby Smith, had also joined this regional firm. This was the old pay-someone-who-knows routine. I knew Kirby from my days at the other regional firm, and we had kept in touch. I had always been impressed with the depth and breadth of his knowledge of the markets. He just knew stuff that I didn't know. It was a classic case of anybody who knows more than I do must really be smart because I know I'm pretty smart. Kirby was brilliant. He really knew what he was talking about in a lot of markets, particularly the grain market. In the summer of 1982, Smith started focusing on the soybean market. The beans had been in a bear market since 1979. Kirby had this really big thing for soybean oil. Soybean oil is made from crushing soybeans into oil and meal. He was talking about how the supply of bean oil was getting tight. There would be a shortage and the price was going to go straight up. Now, all I knew about soybean oil was that it was used to make mayonnaise, and as far as I could see, there were plenty of jars of Hellmann's on the shelf at the grocery store. But as I said, Kirby was brilliant. He knew all there was to know about this market. Pretty soon I began to learn a lot about it too, and I started